I shall start to talk on new results which Håkan Eliasson and I have obtained in last years. Actually, this is the status of the result is the following. So we are now writing paper. We just hope to finish it this summer. So this is more or less the work in progress. Okay. So just let us consider the usual group of nonlinear partial differential equations for a function real or complex is the function u of tx, where t is time and space variable x belongs to a cube of dimension d. And let us consider the following four equations. Equation one is a Schrödinger equation. U dot equals to I Laplacian u plus v of x u plus epsilon f of norm u squared at u. Plus suitable boundary conditions, which will vary. And also, for technical reasons, we shall often replace the term v of x times u. It sometimes will be replaced by the convolution term. It is being done only because convolution is easier, so just it sometimes helps us to waive some technical difficulties. It was Dario also pointed out this small trick in his talk. Second equation is nonlinear wave equation. I shall just put it on the blackboard, but I shall not actually speak about this equation. This is just to put more equation on the list. The third equation is a equation of the KdV type. This is d over dx uxx plus v of x u plus epsilon f of u, where x is now must be one-dimensional. And the fourth equation is the Pitot KdV equation. U dot equals to d over dx uxx plus u squared plus epsilon f of u. And x belongs to the circle again. So the equation four immediately bring us to the main topic of this workshop, because for epsilon equal to zero we have integrable equation. For epsilon positive we have Pitot equation, but also all of them also are, because for epsilon zero we have linear equation which is obviously integrable, and for positive epsilons we have Pitot integrable system obviously. Okay, so this is as usual. I shall take a dynamical system point of view. So, and then we shall consider this equation as a dynamical systems in a suitable function space which is formed by function u of x. And for all three of x, for all three of the equations, this for a space H should be taken as suitable Sobolev function. I shall not specify it. Often we can take H to be L2 space, but this is also, it's also another story. And this is a well-known fact which just everybody here knows, that if you view any one of these equations is an infinite dimensional dynamical system in a carefully chosen functional space, that the equation becomes an infinite dimensional Hamiltonian system. Slightly more specifically, it means the following, that we can provide the space H with a basis Cs formed by pairs Cs1, Cs2, where S is a countable set of indices. For this talk, I shall pretend that this set of indices is a set of natural numbers, but of course, for practical purposes, we usually take for the set of indices Zd, but for a talk, it is better to treat it like this. And then this equation becomes infinite dimensional Hamiltonian system with respect to the symplectic structure defined by the symplectic form omega 2 equals to summation some positive constant kappa s times dus 1 which dus 2 summation over s, where of course us 1 or 2 are Fourier coefficients with respect to the basis. And this basis also is always can be chosen in such a way for these problems, such that Cs1 and Cs2 are the eigenvectors of the linear problem. This is all very well known. This is just to remind language and just remind the object. Okay, then the section two. What happens when epsilon equals to zero? What happens when epsilon equals to zero? Let us first speak about first three equation, when the object which we perturb is a linear system. Is a linear system. Let us take any n integers. Take any n integers, g1 through gn. All of them are integers. All of them are integers. Let us consider the space e to n. Yes, and just as you obviously see, I'm starting with an introduction, so the introduction will be rather extensive, so maybe slightly too extensive, but I decided to do it like this. Okay, then let us consider the space e to n, which is a linear envelope of the vectors phi s1, phi s2, where s is one of these indices which we have chosen. This is a linear space of two dimension. Let us denote by Y, orthogonal complement of this two dimensional space in our space H. So then Y is a Hilbert subspace of my original phase space of the codimension 2n. Then clearly for epsilon equals to zero. For epsilon equals to zero in equation 1 through 3, not in the equation 4, the space E to n is invariant for the equation and is filled with invariant and dimensional torus. Filled with invariant and dimensional torus. Dimension for the torus will be Tn of I. I is the n-dimensional parameter which parameterizes the torus. And then this is how the torus are defined. Of course, everybody saw this guide before, but just still, since as I said, I'm starting with rather extended introduction. So this is how they look like. U J K 1 phi J K 1 plus U 2 J K times phi J K 2, and the condition which defines the story is the following: J K 1 squared plus U J K 2 squared equals to I K, which is a positive parameter. Okay, and so here for I equals to, yes, and here I is n-dimensional, positive n-dimensional parameter, which we just parameterize the torus. And the whole, yes, and this the whole two n-dimensional linear subspace is filled with this n-dimensional torus. Good. Then what is good and what is nice here is this, maybe. What I shall do, I shall try to keep this blackboard for the important formulas, which I shall try to keep on the blackboard for the rest of my talk. So, then this is for equation 1 through 3. Then there is this nice result that the equation 4 for epsilon, which is 0, which is just the KdV equation, also has invariant and dimensional torus Tn of I. These torus are also parameterized by a positive n-dimensional parameter, and these torus are called finite gap torus. And if you consider union of all these torus through the all values of parameter I, then the union cannot be a linear subspace because the equation is essentially nonlinear. But the union is some object of dimension e to n, which is a smooth submanifold of dimension 2n of my phase space H. This is invariant manifold, and this is famous finite gap invariant manifold. And then in both cases, here and here, I shall forever choose and fix on any torus Tn of I, both here and here, usual usual canonical coordinate. So Q from Tn will give me a natural coordinate on any torus Tn of i. So this will be my permanent notation. Okay. So now this is about invariant torsion. Now next short topic also very, very well known. This is about normal form near a torus. This is section 3, normal form near a torus. Well, just what happens here? Let lambda j be the spectrum of the linear problem. So these are eigenvectors, and let lambda s correspond in eigenvalues. Eigenvalues of the linear problem which corresponds to equation 1, 1 through 3 for epsilon equals to 0. And then just let us do. Let us fix any parameter i. Let us call this parameter i naught, and so let us fix it. And then just let us look what happens in our phase space near invariant torus which corresponds to this value of the parameter. Let us denote by pi i minus i naught. So this is then of course this is n-dimensional parameter. Then just of course and this follow from my notations that near the torus Tn of i naught we have natural coordinates, and these natural coordinates are the following. This is P, which is the coordinate along family of the tori, plus Q, which is M coordinate on the torus, as I said, plus Y, which is a point from the space Y capital. And in this coordinates the Hamiltonian is. Now what I shall write down, I shall try to keep on the blackboard as long as possible. So the Hamiltonian has the following form. H equals to summation omega k p times k, I shall explain who is omega k, plus the quadratic path of Hamiltonian in infinite dimensional variable ayy, and of course this is a scalar product both in the space H and just in the space y, and this is the Hamiltonian of the linear problem. And here omega k is nothing but the frequency lambda which corresponds to the jk. And I remind that the j1 through jn, this n frequencies which we just distinguished in the very beginning somewhere here. Okay, so this is the Hamiltonian of the linear problem. And then of course something which comes from perturbation. This is epsilon f of pqi. So this is almost tautology. Now I shall just to save space, I shall erase this remark. And now we shall make obvious transformation of this Hamiltonian. Namely we shall isolate in this Hamiltonian terms which are linear in P and linear and quadratic in Y. And the result of this isolation is the following form of Hamiltonian H. H equals to omega k times pk plus quadratic path AYY plus comes the rest, plus epsilon. Now look, I'm trying to isolate these terms, so namely, as I promised, linear in P and linear in Y and quadratic in Y. Well, first come terms which are order 0 and P and in Y. Next come terms which are linear in P. They have the following form: fp of q scalar product with p. Now are coming terms which are linear in y. They are fy of qy. Finally comes a term f which is quadratic in y. This is fyy in qyy. Yes, this is quadratic in y object. And also something is left after all the truncations and separations, and this is the term. And what is the rest, I shall denote f3 of pqy. And clearly f3, since well, this is obvious in this decomposition, and this is essentially Taylor formula, that f3 is O capital of norm p squared plus norm y cubed plus norm p times norm y. Okay, so this is almost obvious. So this is the important for the whole business which will follow, for the whole industry, I would say, normal form of the Hamiltonian of equation 1 through 3, which we can achieve near in the vicinity of any fixed and dimensional torus, which is an invariant torus for the corresponding linear system. Of course, this trivial logic doesn't apply to the perturbation of the Kadewia equation, so the corresponding result, but the corresponding result is true. And this is theorem. This is theorem 1, and this is now old result. It's my result from the year 1989. And the result is, and this is important for me. This will be normal form number. This formula is the relation number 5. The relation number 5. And the theorem is the following. If we consider not, okay, and the, right? Question, can I? It's fine. It's okay. Okay, good. Well, Okay. So then this applies for the equation 1 through 3. And now what we have for equation 4. For equation 4, we have the following result. For equation four, the normal form 5 also exists near any torus Tn of i, but in this normal form, the remaining term epsilon times f3 of pqy does not have a small factor epsilon in front, so it should be replaced. If this is just f3 of, it does not, of pqy, yes. But this is absolutely irrelevant because everybody understands that since we study the whole Hamiltonian in the vicinity of the torus, then we study the Hamiltonian near the point where p is 0 and y is 0. So the term f3 is very small by itself due to the smallest condition, right? So this extra small factor in front of just is not at all needed. So this normal form is just as good as the original one. And now this is absolutely non-trivial result. This is really difficult result. And it can be found now in my book, which is Oxford University Press in the year 2000, and as well with different proof. With different proof, it can be found in a book by Kappeler Pershing, which has beautifully short title, KDV and KAM, or maybe as well. But this really, it's a difficult result. Okay, so now this is a normal form. This is now what we have there, and now just let us move forward. Now let's move forward. Let me start with the problems with the equations 1 through 4 when d equals to 1. Of course, equations 3 and 4, they are one-dimensional by definition. So now the point is that let us first start with situation where in equation 1 and 2 we have d equal to 1. So this is 1D case. 1D case. 1D case. Okay. So now I am going to present a theorem and a theory which applies in one-dimensional cases. Therefore, I shall make now assumption which holds for equation 1 through 4 in one-dimensional case, with only exception. We should not consider equation 1 and 2 under periodic boundary condition. What this assumption is? This is the following one. Assume that. And this is the assumption 6. This is the assumption 6, and the assumption 6 is the following, that lambda j equals to constant times g to 2 degree d plus O small times j to 2 degree d minus 1. And what is absolutely important that here d is at least 1. This assumption can be slightly weakened, but really slightly. I cannot dwell on this. Oops, Walter, thanks. Thanks. Oh, yeah. Thank you very much. D tilde. Thank you, Walter. This is just my notation which I'm used to. Yes, of course. Okay, let us start with the situation. Let us assume that our unperturbed problem, as usual, depends on the additional parameter, and we shall do it in the following way. Let us assume that the potential V of X, in fact, depends on additional n dimensional parameter A. Here, this additional parameter A belongs to a bounded, nice, good, smooth n dimensional domain. And let us assume that our potential is analytic in this additional parameter. Analytic in A. Then here comes the following theorem two. If six holds and the parameter VXA is non-degenerate in A, it means that it satisfies some rather non-restrictive conditions, which of course holds in a generic case. If so, then for most values of this parameter, the unperturbed torus TN I0 persists in the equation, and now I shall write down that in equation 5, because this is essentially something like this. For provided that epsilon is sufficiently small. Well, it is filled with time quasi-periodic solution. It is filled with time quasi-periodic solutions, which are linearly stable. And linearly stable means that all Lyapunov exponents of this solutions vanish. And that's the case. So what is? Okay, lambda j's are eigenvalues of the linear problem. They're eigenvalues of the problem which we have if we put the epsilon equal to 0. Then, among parameters j, I have distinguished n parameters. And the corresponding lambda j's, I have already noted as omega. So omega is n-dimensional parameters. These are n out of all lambda j's. And from now on, actually, lambda j, these are essentially infinity minus n lambda j's. Okay, well, just so This is now old story, which is essentially 15 years, more than 15 years old. So it was, this was proven in my, in three my papers in 87, 89, also independently by Gene Wayne in his paper 1990, also later a number of really nice papers on this scheme, on this proof were written by Jürgen Pöschel after the year 1996. Well, also maybe I should say that a very nice presentation of the scheme Questions? Or just a joke? Ah, Jürgen, what is wrong? Ah, well, yes. And also maybe I wish to point out that a very nice presentation of the scheme is given by a short book by Walter Craig, which is a short book in the year 2000 that is in French, but just everybody can couple with Walter's French. Well, I'm sorry. Yes, okay, so I cannot mention here all important contributions, because Dario has important contribution, and also again, can you have important reprint from the last year. But just I cannot dwell on this subject. There is one important restriction. All these references apply to the case when the equation under discussion is a semilinear. So when the perturbation contains no derivatives at all. And the case of quasi-linear equations. And equation 3, for example, is a quasi-linear equation. Perturbation contains one derivative. Equation 4 also is a quasi-linear. Was actually proven rigorously later. This is my result from the year 1998. It is not as old, it stayed as a preprint for 4 years, essentially. Yes, essentially it was a preprint because there were no really serious public interest in this result. Okay, so this is theorem two. But now, of course, let me draw your attention that theorem one plus theorem two applies to the Pitovka-DV equation. Applies to the Pitovka-DV equation, which is the equation four in my notation. Good. So this is a state of affairs which is more or less well understood now, because it is 15 years old. Now just let us move forward. So this is very nice. So this result applies to equation 1 through 4. If boundary conditions are not periodic in equation 1 through 2, and if space dimension is 1. Why space dimension is 1? Because the condition 6, which is crucial there, namely its part, the d, is bigger than 1, this holds for all equations with one-dimensional space variable, but it actually never holds for equation with space dimension bigger than 2. Yes. This is spectrum. J cubed. Well, just it depends. Okay, so just let us consider equation 3. This is I cannot give just everything rigorously. So, but the law of growth, no matter how we define lambda j, is okay for the KdV case. D tilde equal to 3. This is an absolutely rigorous statement. Okay. Lambda j grows as j cubed. This is absolutely rigorous statement. So for the KdV equation, this condition holds brilliantly. Now, okay, I'm just slightly behind my scheme, so I gave two good introduction. So just now, what I wish to tell. What is the next section? Should be a couple of words about the proof, scheme of the proof. Maybe I'm not behind. So couple of words. What is the scheme of the proof? Scheme of the proof, which is used to prove theorem 3, theorem 2. This is called Melnikov scheme. And the Melnikov scheme, this is the following stuff. Melnikov scheme. Melnikov scheme is the following stuff. So let us observe that in the normal form 5, we have F equals to FP. Okay, if in the normal form 5, F equals to FP equals to FY equals to FYY equals to 0, if all this stuff is equal to 0, then obviously the trivial torus, which is the torus where we put P and Y equals to 0, this torus is obviously invariant for the equation. So if we achieve this, then we obviously trivially have an invariant torus for our equation. So then the natural idea, and this is what the Melnikov scheme is to run subsequent changes of variable such that as a result of this change of variable, and we have, as every KM person here knows, we need infinitely many of them, just to achieve final normal form where just all these four coefficients equal to zero. So we really make subsequent changes of variables such that each change of variable in first approximation kills in the Hamiltonian exactly this four terms. And then we just iterate the scheme, and as a limit of the scheme, we shall arrive at a limit in Hamiltonian where this nice relation really holds. And how, as a result of infinitely many changes of variable, we really obtain invariant and dimensional torus for the system. What are the difficulties of the scheme? What are the difficulties of the scheme? The difficulties are the following. First, that to run this scheme, we have to solve homological equation, because any change of variable can be defined only after we solve homological equation. And there are four homological equations because we have four terms to kill. And the most difficult homological equation is the following one. And this is extremely important for me, so this is the key point. So this is the equation 7. This equation has the following form. I times gradient in Q scalar product with omega tilde, I shall explain who is omega tilde, apply to unknown operator J of Q plus commutator of the operator J times J A tilde with the unknown operator J of Q. This equals to the right-hand side, which is the operator FYY of Q. And the operator FYY of Q is exactly the guy in the formula 5. So here, G is unknown operator from Y to Y. And here, A tilde equals to epsilon plus small Q independent perturbation. And this Q independent perturbation comes from the previous KM step. Altogether, what we have here is an operator for the epsilon. The epsilon is exactly the one which we have up there. But it is crucial for the Melnikov scheme that this is a constant coefficient operator. No Q dependents are there. And also omega tilde is omega plus small Q independent perturbation, which comes from the previous step, and they also are for the epsilon. And this is A plus over capital of epsilon. Okay, so this is the first difficulty that we can, okay, the first two equations, they are just easy, they are just exactly in the equation from the papers in Komagura, Bronwald, and Moser. The third equation is difficult than the first one, but it is easier than 7. But this is really the one who is really responsible for all difficulties which we have. And the second difficulty which we have here, this is the difficulty, the necessity to control smoothness of transformations, smoothness of transformations, and of the perturbation Hamiltonians epsilon f, and of the Hamiltonians epsilon f, which is a perturbation which I have at the step number n. And here there is one remark which is almost tautological now, but let me point it now. That smoothness of transformations smoothness of the perturbation, and smoothness of the perturbation epsilon f, these two qualities, the phenomena, they are in positive feedback relation. What does it mean? Because to construct transformation, we have to solve homological equations in terms of f. So smoothness of the perturbation, which we have at step number n, dictate smoothness of the transformation from step number n to step number n plus 1. To get Hamiltonian at the step number n plus 1, I have to take my old Hamiltonian and just make a convolution with transformation number n. So smoothness of transformation number n dictates the smoothness of Hamiltonian number n plus 1. Okay, and this is, by the way, this is very important and technically difficult part of the proof of theorem 2, just to find a balance for these two smoothnesses, which smoothnesses can be that we can run the scheme forward. And here the answer is, essentially the answer is the following. We have to control the size of the Hamiltonian F and the size of its gradient. The gradient, of course, should be controlled in some functional norm. Okay. Now, so this is nice, this is a good scheme, but the scheme does not work for periodic boundary condition, and it does not work for high space dimension. And then just to address these two problems, Walter Craig and Jean Wayne, which are here, just suggested in the year 1992, another KM scheme, which is now called Craig-Wayne or Craig-Wayne-Burgain scheme, because Jean Burgain pushed it substantially further later on. Just in these notations, I can easily explain what the scheme is about. The scheme is the following. So look, let us please note, and this is really, really important, but just trivial remark. So look, the trivial torus with P equals 0, Y equals 0, will be invariant for this Hamiltonian, not only if this guy vanishes, this guy vanishes, this guy vanishes, and this guy vanishes, but only if these three guys vanish. So to have this torus invariant for equation, we should not at all vanish quadratic part of Hamiltonian. So in the Craig-Wayne-Burgain scheme, instead of to kill quadratic part of perturbation, they just leave it how it is, and they just add it to the original quadratic part of Hamiltonian. In this way, they should not kill four objects, but only three. But they have to pay a lot for this profit, because in this way the equation, the most difficult equation which they have to solve now is equation number three, and this equation is the following. This is the same operator. Operator which I have here, right? So this is the usual KM operator. Now it applies to a function g of q, which is a function defined on the torus valued in the space y. And this is what I have here else. G of q. So this equation could look simpler, because unknown object now is not an operator but a vector. But in fact, that is much more difficult. It is much more difficult due to the fact that now the quadratic part here depends on q. In the equation seven, it was q independent. Now equation looks simpler, but its quadratic part has variable coefficients. Now, as I said, Jean Burgain pushed the scheme much further, and the most important his achievement was that in the year 1998. In his paper in Annals of Mathematics, which is in fact 76 pages long paper, he proved that the scheme applies to prove stability, persistence of the torus Tn for the equation 1 with d equal to 2. So he applied this scheme for equation 1 for d equal to 2. This was really breakthrough because this is first result where KAM result was obtained for partial differential equations which are not one-dimensional. He recovered essentially theorem 2 without specification that the solutions are linearly stable. This is another disadvantage of Craig-Wayne-Bruggen scheme because it cannot prove that the solutions are linearly stable. Now this year, in a book which should appear this year, he pushed this technique further based on his joint papers with Michael Goldstein and with Schlack, and in this book, this result is proven for any dimension. But I'll just look. Even in this case, this is very technical and very, very serious job. Because please know that even two-dimensional paper is 76 page long. So and both Håkon Eliasson and I we did not believe that in this situation Craig-Wayne-Bruggen scheme has advantages compared to the Melnikov scheme. And so 3 years ago we started to check if we can push Melnikov scheme further to first recapture Bruggen result about dimension 2 and also then just maybe to prove a dimensional case. And now we can state that the answer is yes. Melnikov scheme really implies to equation 1 and 2 in higher space dimension, and this is based in two claims which we made. Claim 1 is that we can solve equation 7. For nonlinear Schrödinger equation for any d, if we have good control of the operator A tilde. And the operator A tilde, this is the changed, okay, so this is the quadratic part if we have at the step number m. If we have good control of the operator A tilde. Claim number 2 is the following. That we can achieve good control of the operator A tilde. Through good control of the KAM transformation. of the smoothness of the perturbation epsilon f, which you have at the step number n of KM construction. Here comes our substantial technical discovery. Discovery is the following. Let me remind you that in one-dimensional case, when we transform Hamiltonian, that we need to control the size of Hamiltonian and the size of its gradients. Now we have to control by controlling the size of the Hamiltonian epsilon f, the size of its gradient, and also the size of its Hessian. Now, just to save that. So now what I'm going to say. So the real point here, how we control size of the quadratical part of the Hamiltonian. This was the real point, and this was our technical discovery. So we believe that it's really technical, so we just put this stuff as an independent paper. I shall explain why. So look, how to control. Because when we control smoothness of Hamiltonian, this immediately the question arises, smoothness, we have to control size. Okay, this is a Hilbert matrix. This is an operator in a Hilbert space. Which norm of this operator has the control? The answer, new norm, new norm. So the technical discovery of this our 3 years exercises with Hawking is that is the following claim. We consider new class of Hilbert matrices. Because this is a Hilbert matrix, yes? So now I shall define new class of Hilbert matrix, and then the claim is that we have to control the norm of the Hessian in this class of Hilbert matrices. Which we call this class of Hilbert matrices Lipschitz-Stieplitz. So that what we need is that the Hessian belongs to this class of Lipschitz-Stieplitz matrices. Now just another 1 or maybe 2 minutes definition of this Lipschitz-Stieplitz class. So, but this really is the whole point. So this is why the whole machinery, because one of the main difficulties of KAM technique, which everybody knows, is the business of bookkeeping. So in which way to keep information of the perturbation Hamiltonian F, which changes from just step to step. And here our answer for this bookkeeping is the following. Let us define new operator norm, and let us just control this new operator norm of the Hessian function F. And this is how this, okay, just to define this new operator norm is more or less to define the class of operators for which this new norm is finite. And this class is defined in the following way. So look, this is my Hilbert matrix. It is parameterized by it is infinite. I have Hilbert matrices A, S, S prime, where just S and S prime are natural numbers. And this is the matrix. Of course, I have a diagonal here. Okay. And now look. Hilbert matrix A, which is A, S, S prime, where both S, S prime belong to the set of natural numbers. This matrix belong to the class of Lipschitz-Stieplitz matrices. If the following happens. First, this is the same as in the Craig-Weinberg-Gain scheme. That first, this matrix should, element of this matrix should exponentially decay out of diagonal. A of S, S prime is smaller than C exponent of minus delta norm of S minus S prime. This, of course, for all S, S prime, and for some C and delta, because it's a part of the norm, of course, C and delta. And now, but this is usual. This is how it was all the time. Now the key point is the following. In what? So now this is the crux of the whole object. Look, the matrix restricted to any line. Parallel to the diagonal, which is blue there, to the diagonal, is a Lipschitz sequence. Now I shall explain what does it mean. Sequence. Now look, let us consider lines parallel of diagonal. These are these ones, right? Matrix is called Stieplitz if when we restrict matrix element to this line, then this element is just depend only on the line, but not on a point on the line. Now the matrix is called Lipschitz-Stieplitz if the following happens. For any A, which belongs to the N, for any B1, B2, which belongs to the set of natural numbers plus zero, let us consider the following function. F of t equals 2. It, of course, it depends on A, B1, B2 of t. And this is just matrix element which stands on the position TA plus B1, TA plus B2. Yes? So you obviously see that that when t runs from zero, yes, and here t belongs to the n times a minus 1. So in this way, I just clearly parameterize elements of this line, correct? And then now the last line of my talk is the following. That in terms of the function tau, which goes to f of 1 over tau, should be Lipschitz at tau equals to 0. What does it mean? This means something really crucial. This means that when we move along this line to infinity, that near infinity, element of the matrix behave nice asymptotic behavior. Then this is the definition of the class of matrices. Then last remark, that first there is, this is, I define the class. I did not, this is example. I did not define the norm. Definition of the norm is a rather technical. It's a know-how, so you should wait for a couple of months when we hope to finish this stuff. And also, what is really beautiful here is that the theorem is that this class of matrices form an algebra. If we multiply two Lipschitz surplus matrices, we have a Lipschitz surplus matrices. Therefore, when we start to run KM machinery, we shall never leave the class of we start with topless matrices. They don't form algebra. We shall lose. Okay, they are not invariant for our transformations. But Lipschitz topless matrices is a bigger class, which include topless matrices, and which is invariant for all transformations which we have in KM scheme. If we add Lipschitz topless matrices, the result is Lipschitz topless. Theorem, not at all trivial. That if we multiply two Lipschitz topless matrices, the result is Lipschitz topless. Theorem number three, if you have a linear equation with a Lipschitz topless coefficient, then the flow maps also Lipschitz topless. Actually, so yes, and this is now written as just independent paper on linear algebra, so there will be two papers, one on linear algebra of Lipschitz topless matrices, and second on its application to prove. And Håkan will give some details in his talk. Thank you very much.